might think I'm a complete idiot for saying that because you've never felt that way. Or you did feel that way and somebody shut you down. Or you thought to yourself, oh, I think I have this gift, and you tried to share it with the world, and it was rejected, or it went really poorly, or you failed in some way, or you were really, really successful, and you killed it, and nobody acknowledged it. Nobody noticed it. Has anybody ever felt that way? Okay, so how many people in this room have ever struggled to make a decision? Okay, every hand should definitely go up. You're lying if your hand is not raised right now. How many people have ever made a decision and regretted it? Okay, yeah, both, all the way. How many people have made a decision and been very happy with the decision that they made? See, we all have gifts, and we all have to choose what to do in certain situations in our lives with those gifts. And how many people have ever had a crush? Let's hit the dating part, yeah? Okay, we'll get to dating eventually, I promise. Basically, I'm going to tell you don't do it in high school, and you're going to hate me, but that's okay. I'll tell you why. See, here's the beautiful thing about a Steubenville conference. We can throw all of this. I'm from the South, so it's like we're making gumbo. I've got a little chicken. I've got some sausage. I'm going to throw in some okra. We'll get some filet on the top, and we'll see what happens at the end. There's no secret to how you make gumbo. There's really not. And some of you are thinking, okay, who is she again? Gumbo is literally a pot of a bunch of stuff. That is the beauty of it. So we're going to make gumbo in this workshop. We're going to talk a little bit about the gifts that you have and how you could use them for God. And we're going to talk a little bit about how we can choose to do things for the greater glory of God. And then maybe at the end we'll talk about how you can, like, get together with that cute boy or that cute girl. But the point is, we can hit all of these things if we keep one thing in mind. If you remember nothing else I say, remember this. Some of you are taking notes. This is where you write it down. There will be a quiz. I am a teacher. I'll post it on Twitter later. It'll be a poll. Those are things. They're so cool. Your life is meant to glorify God. Period. Done. I can drop the mic and walk away, and they won't fire me. They already gave me my check, so we're good. Your life is meant to glorify God. From the moment you wake up in the morning to the moment you lay your pillow down on the bed, your life is meant to glorify God. In the things you say, in the way you act, in the conversations you have, and the conversations you don't have, and the prayers you pray, and the prayers you don't want to pray, in the moments where you find incredible success, and in the deep moments of intense failure and hurt and pain, your life is meant to glorify God. And when your life is in sync with the will of God, when your desires are God's desires, when your choices are made with His greater purpose in mind, your life becomes this beautiful symphony in harmony with the greatest conductor that ever set foot on the face of the earth. Your life becomes such that you no longer just have happiness, but true joy. Where you become a person that somebody else looks at you and says, I want that. They've got something and I want it. You know, Mother Teresa, she's going to be canonized in September. So she's bomb, right? Like she's arguably the holiest person that has walked the face of the planet in the past 100 years, right? This woman, I remember being a kid and like seeing images of her on television, and I was always amazed. Isn't it interesting, by the way, that like when our Pope dies, like the whole world stops? Like a little man in white becomes the top news story on every channel. Catholicism is relevant. People say it's not, but it is. But isn't it interesting that when Mother Teresa won the Nobel Peace Prize, they broadcast her acceptance speech? When she died, her funeral was the top news story across the world. Princess Diana died in the same week that she died, and Mother Teresa's funeral was first. They postponed Princess Diana's funeral so that world leaders could go to Mother Teresa's. Some of you are way too young to remember that. But why is it that this little, she was less than 5 feet, this little tiny woman with wrinkles so deep you could stick a quarter in her face and it would stay there, right? Like, this woman was beautiful. This woman would speak and say things that anybody else would be called a bigot for. And people would listen to her and believe her. This woman would go into the streets of Calcutta, India, one of the poorest places in the world, and grab people, regardless of race, religion, creed, background, or illness, and pick them up and bring them into her home for the sick and the dying and restore their human dignity in the last moments of their life. How could she do that? How could this woman, who had arguably nothing to her name, my mom and dad, I don't tell this story very often because they usually get embarrassed when I tell it, but I'm going to tell it because I like you. My mom and dad, my mom converted to Catholicism in the 1980s. She was raised Southern Baptist. Like, she was raised to think that Catholics were nuts. And then she met my dad, and she realized, well, he's not nuts. Well, he is, but I don't think it's the Catholicism. And so she looked into the faith a little bit. And my grandmother, may she rest in peace, Grandma Rose, was a very stern woman. So, like, my dad was not marrying a Southern Baptist. And my mom's parents, who are now Catholic, but at the time were very stern Southern Baptists, where you ain't marrying no Catholic. So there's a little bit of tension in the family at the time. So long story short, my mom eventually converts. It's really cool with, like, Our Lady and the intercession of Our Lady and their relationship. And when they got married in the Diocese of Lake Charles, which is a mission diocese from the Diocese of Lafayette in the 1980s, the priest that married them was the Vicar General of the Diocese of Lafayette. And the Vicar General of the Diocese of Lafayette was very influential in getting Mother Teresa to visit Lafayette. So my parents were in the car with Mother Teresa when she was driven from the airport to the Cajun Dome. So my parents, like, sat in a vehicle with a saint. Like, that still blows my mind. I will never do anything as cool as that. And the whole time my mom was like, the one thing I could not get over was the fact that she didn't have any luggage. The woman traveled with, like, a small bag with an extra sari, a toothbrush, and her Bible. She had nothing to her name. But that smile could stop people in their tracks. Those words could cut through somebody's cold heart and warm it. Why? How? That woman lived a life glorifying God. Not herself. It wasn't, hey, look at me, I'm Teresa of Calcutta, who started this awesome group of nuns that, like, walk around and help dying people. She went out into the world and she proclaimed a message bigger than herself, better than herself, greater than any sorrow or sin she had ever suffered. She went out into the world and took the gift of compassion, the gift of patience, the gift of wisdom, and she used those gifts. She chose to use those gifts to help people who had less than her. And in the scriptures, in the book of 1 Peter, which is a letter from Peter the Apostle to a group of what we can assume are, like, early Christians. So it's this letter from arguably the biggest screw-up in scripture. If you look at Peter again and again, there are moments of complete failure. This is the guy that denied Jesus 3 times. This is the guy. My favorite is when Jesus is like, bring some fish to the shore. And Peter's like, I got it, Jesus. And he grabs the whole net and, like, drags it up. And Jesus is like, okay, well, that one's bad and that one's bad. And I don't think we're going to need this one. Peter's like the very bombastic, gregarious, like, look at me, I'm Peter, I love Jesus, and then he falls. And Peter is touched by the Lord's command to love him, to love him, to love him, to serve the sheep, to feed the sheep. If he can be the first pope and a saint, there is hope for everybody. Well, Peter writes in this letter, and it's, think about this context. This is a man that was picked out from the crowd by Jesus, a fisherman, a nobody, picked out of the crowd to follow Jesus, to be the leader of the apostles, to be the mouthpiece of the church in its earliest days and arguably some of its toughest days. This is what he says. As each one has received a gift, use it to serve one another as good stewards of God's varied grace. Whoever preaches, let it be with the words of God. Whoever serves, let it be with the strength that God supplies, so that in all things God may be glorified through Jesus Christ, to whom belong glory and dominion forever and ever. Peter writes this early Christian community who's probably struggling to remain Christian, who's probably grappling with the doctrines of this faith, of a faith that professes that there was a man that was killed and then rose from the dead, that said, eat my flesh and drink my blood. Maybe we are crazy. He's writing to a group of people that are struggling to live their faith authentically. We're probably trying to figure out, where do we fit in the framework of the culture and of the world? How can our faith be something that other people see and they don't mock us for it? And he says, those gifts that you have, use them to glorify God. Talk about God. Serve others as God would have served you. Now, I'm talking a big game and I'm saying some really nice theological things. I'm essentially telling you that when you leave this Steubenville conference, You should walk back into your youth groups and in your cafeterias. Once school begins, you should be grabbing Bibles and shouting, "Repent! The gospel is at hand." Don't do that. They'll look at you like you're crazy. I'm not speaking from experience, I promise. I'm essentially telling you that, you know what, if you say that you're a Christian and if you actually love Jesus, then that should be the thing that you talk about the most. That should be the thing that people notice about you first. That should be the thing that is most absolute in your life. And if I'm telling you those things from this place of like lofty theological authority, you're not going to believe me. So let me tell you a story about when I failed miserably at doing that. Failed miserably at using the gifts, failed miserably at serving other people, failed miserably at letting my life glorify God. When I graduated from the University of Dallas in 2011, I graduated with a degree in theology. And you can really do like one of three things with a degree in theology. You can teach, you can be a youth minister, you can become a nun. The third one was not on my radar, so it was either teaching or youth ministry. And for those in the room that are theology majors, I'm making a joke. You can do a lot more with that. You can go to like get your graduate degree in theology. Anyway, so good luck. Debt forever. So I decided to go be a youth minister. I got a job in Chicago. Go Bears. And I moved 1,400 miles away from my hometown to a place where there is this thing called snow, which I'd seen like two times in my entire life. So the first time that it snowed, I called my mom crying because I didn't have a shovel and I didn't know how to get my car out of the snow. So just picture me in tennis shoes, bad idea, like kicking snow away from the tires of my Jeep. My landlord, who was this 78-year-old Croatian woman, was laughing at me from the window. It was a beautiful day in my life. So I moved up to Chicago, and I was a youth minister in a parish in one of the wealthiest parishes in the country and one of the most expensive parts of the country, Lake Forest, Illinois. Oprah and Michael Jordan and Vince Vaughn have houses in this town. The high school is an old mansion that they've built behind these gorgeous, like, vines. It's like something out of Madeline, like the little children's novel about the French girls in the orphanage. Like, that's what the school looks like. And I was the first youth minister in the parish in 2 years. And the last youth minister that they'd had had done a pretty terrible job of building relationship with kids. So they changed the confirmation program. I basically walked into chaos of a youth ministry program and struggled greatly and was very unhappy and very miserable, very lonely. So I moved home because, you know, I ran away from my problems. And so and I'm not suggesting that, but I'm just trying to accelerate the story. But I'm up there and I was like, okay, you know what? I need to find something that I can do that I'm good at and that I enjoy and that can glorify God and I'm not lonely and scared of the snow. So I moved back to Lake Charles, Louisiana and became a teacher in the school that I now teach at. I teach freshman theology in the classroom I once took freshman theology in, so that's pretty cool, full circle. And I became the youth minister at the parish that I'd grown up in, parish of 2,500 families. We have about 600 youth in our program between Life Teen and Edge, just a big beast of a parish, and I was traveling and speaking. So I was pretty much running myself into the ground. But everybody knew me as Katie the Catholic. Like, that was kind of like who I was in town. Especially because I'd been gone for the past 5 years. I'd gone to college, I'd moved to Chicago, now I was back. You're going to discover very quickly, making friends as an adult is hard. It's tough. It's not like you're in high school and you have all these classes together. Now you all have jobs from 8 to 5 and then social lives that you somehow have to foster. So I'm finding myself really struggling. I'm working a lot. I was home, but I was still just as lonely as when I lived up in Chicago. The only benefit was that there wasn't snow I had to kick away from my wheels. So here I was, lonely, tired, working really hard. And my friend Megan, who's a beautiful soul, she just got her master's in arts from a school in New Jersey. She called me up one night and she said, "Hey, Katie, what you doing tonight?" It's like, nothing really, you know, Netflix, the usual. She's like, "Well, why don't you come hang out with a group of us? We're going down to Luna Live. It's a local bar in town. There's a band playing. It's $10 cover, but, you know, thought you might be interested in coming." It's like, sure, yeah, why not? No, who's going? So she named some people. I didn't know any of them. But, you know, that's how you make friends. You go hang out with people you don't know. So I threw on some, you know, like a nice blouse and, like, cute pants, and I went. I showed up, and we're all hanging out outside, and I'm meeting the people and, you know, and having, like, those awkward get-to-know-you conversations. And all I said was I was a teacher when somebody asked me, "Hey, what do you do?" I was like, I teach at St. Louis. Well, as everybody's, like, filing into the bar, like, 15 minutes later after we've all met and said our hellos, Megan, my good friend, I had a cross around my neck, very similar to the one I'm wearing now. Not like this gigantic, like, wall crucifix on my chest that, like, announced, "Hello, I am Catholic." Like, it was just like a little cross. My sister had given it to me when I graduated college. She sees me with the cross, and she reaches up, and she takes it, and she just tucks it under my shirt. And she went, "There, now you're ready." And she walked in. And I didn't, at the moment, I didn't think like, how dare she, heathen, right? Like, and like grab it out and walk in with my pitchfork and like prepare for exorcism. But like, I which would be cool, but I just left it there. Like, I didn't pull the cross out. I didn't say like, why'd you do that? I just left it there. And I walked in and watched the band play and hung out with the people and like went about my night. And it wasn't until I got home and I was getting ready for bed that I realized the cross had been under my shirt the whole night. And it bugged me. Like, I couldn't sleep that night. And the whole next day it bothered me, and like the whole next week, to where eventually I texted her and I was like, hey, let's go grab lunch. I have a question for you. Like, that's a terrible way to make friends. Hey, let's have lunch. I have questions for you. Like, that is red flag. Fortunately, we were already friends. So we went and had lunch, and we're just hanging out. And I finally had the guts to be like, hey, why did you hide my cross last week? And she very simply said, and I hold this against her, not at all. So the way I should have said that sentence was, I don't hold this against her. it's been a long day. And she very simply said, well, Katie, you know, you're a religion teacher, and I didn't want you to have to, like, constantly be talking about your faith. Like, I figured, like, if they knew that you're a religion teacher and they saw the cross and, like, they noticed it, like, they might bug you a lot. And, like, I just wanted you to have a good time. I didn't want you to have to, like, worry about all that Catholic stuff. And I know she didn't mean anything by it. Like, she didn't mean anything malicious. And, like, she wasn't attacking Catholicism. She's Catholic. And, like, she wasn't, like, degrading my faith and being like, how dare you be a religion teacher, you bigot. Like, it was just, she thought she was looking out for me. She thought she was doing me a favor, like saving me from having to talk about my faith. And y'all, that's the culture in which we live. People think that faith, our religion, our Catholicism is like a jacket that we can take off and on. And when it gets a little too heated in the conversation, we just take it off so that we're a little more comfortable. It's something that we put on from 9 to 10 a.m. on Sunday mornings and make sure that Father sees us with our jacket, and then we whip it off in the car and turn up Drake and, you know, bounce our way home. Don't even think about the fact that we just talked about living our faith in day-to-day life, and now we're listening to crap. Like, here's the thing. I'm not saying, and that's not a commentary on Drake's musical prowess. I'm just saying. The thing is, our religion, our faith, is not something that should be hidden under a shirt for comfort. It's not a jacket to be taken off and on. If our life is truly meant to glorify God, the gifts and the talents that we have, whether we're hanging out at a bar with our friends, sitting in the cafeteria with the people that we have lunch with every day, talking to our teacher about an assignment, or going into church, our Catholicism should be something visible. Not in this shove-it-down-your-throat way. Why was Mother Teresa able to sit at tables with dignitaries, able to have breakfast with Hillary Clinton, able to receive the Nobel Peace Prize, and people sit peacefully with her and listen to her? Because it was a completely authentic expression of a truth that had changed her life. When you have the chance to encounter Jesus Christ, as we did last night in the Eucharist, as we did this morning at Mass, as we will throughout the rest of this weekend in your small groups and chances to have conversations with each other through the talks, through the moments of silence and prayer and confession, and every moment that you encounter Jesus Christ, something inside of you is changing. Those gifts are being honed to be used for him. Those choices that you have to make are becoming easier because your focus is redirected to him. The life that you live becomes one that glorifies God, glorifies Christ, because you're like gold that's being forged into something beautiful. You're like clay that's being formed into this gorgeous vessel that he can then use for the world. See, we all have these gifts that we want to use, all have these things that we want to share. And we think, I just don't know how. One of my youth group kids, I'm not a youth minister anymore. I left the position in May, but they're still my kids. One of my youth group students, he is a beautiful artist. And he came to me one day and he said, hey, I have this idea. It's kind of random, but I can't get it out of my head. I have these sketches of Stations of the Cross. I was hoping I could maybe do something with them. And so we bought him the supplies to create canvases for all the Stations of the Cross to hang in our youth house. The kid's, he's an artist, and like anime all the way to like portraitures. Like, this kid is incredibly talented. And he just had the guts and the gumption to come to his youth minister and say, hey, I have this idea. What would it look like if you had the guts and the gumption to do that with your gifts and talents, whether it's art, whether it's music, whether it's listening? You might sit there and think, this is some sort of talent, like holding a microphone and talking about Jesus. Let me tell you something. I shut up and let him talk 99% of the time. This is not a talent. Sitting there and listening to somebody pour out their heart and being able to be with them in their mess and in their hurt, that's a gift. And some of you in this room have that gift. Some of you in this room are so incredibly compassionate and tender-hearted that you can sit with people in their pain and love them. That's a gift. Some of you in this room have such an incredible sense of humor that it does not matter how uncomfortable or awkward people are, you are able to make them smile. That's a gift. And some of you in this room are sitting here thinking right now, I don't have a gift, or I don't know what my gift is. And you know the best way to find out what your gift is? Ask God to tell you. And that's going to be my jump-off point into this next little segment. Asking God to tell you means that you ask a question, and then you listen. In a conversation of two people, usually the more intelligent person is the one that does most of the talking. So if you're talking to God, who should be doing most of the talking? God. We need to learn to hush and go to the Father and let him talk to us. And if you're sitting there thinking, well, what does his voice sound like? Never really heard it. And that's okay. Because it's not necessarily an audible thing. It's a movement. It's an understanding. It's a recognition that the steps that you were taking and the things that you were doing and the movements in your life are oriented to his greater glory. There's two questions you should always ask yourself when you're about to do something, especially if it's in service of the church or in service of other people or in an attempt to glorify God, or if you're just trying to figure out what you're going to wear that day. Honestly, two questions. First question, does what I'm about to do make me a better person? Is virtue going to be augmented in my life? Am I going to be more honest? Am I going to be more patient? Am I going to be more wise? Am I going to have fortitude? Am I going to have temperance? Am I going to be charitable? Am I going to have faith? Is what I'm about to do going to make me a better person? And the second question, is what I'm about to do going to draw me closer to God? And unequivocally, without question, the answers have to be yes. If it's going to make you, what's the opposite of a better person? A worse person? If it's going to make you a worse person, don't do it. And if it's going to lead you away from the creator of the universe who loved you into existence, run away. If you find yourself in a position to do something that makes you better, that gives glory to God and draws you closer to God, have the courage to do it. And that's the part of discernment that we forget about. We all want to talk about asking the question and then listening to the answer, but what happens when you hear the answer or feel the answer or know this is what I'm supposed to do, this is going to make me better, and this is going to draw me closer to God? You got to have guts. You have to do it. You have to jump out of the boat. It's one of my favorite Peter stories. Peter's like in the boat with his fisherman buddies, and here comes Ninja Jesus walking on the water. It's my second favorite kind of Jesus. I'll tell you my first favorite kind tonight in the keynote. It's the fun one. I mean, Jesus is great all the time, but I've got a first and second favorite type. Here comes Ninja Jesus walking on. All the nuns in the room are shaking their head, like hands down. Like, oh goodness, I'm sorry, sister. Here comes Jesus walking on the water, and Peter sees him. He's like, whoa. Is that Jesus? And we've got gregarious Peter like, I'm coming! And he like leaps out of the boat onto the water. And Jesus reaches out his hand. And Peter is defying the laws of physics. Literally, he is. I mean, the Bible is awesome. We've got talking donkeys. We'd have miraculous shadows. And we have Peter. That's not an exaggeration. Those things are in there. And we have Peter walking on water. For a brief moment, he is defying what the world says is normal and right because of the power of God. And as he's walking towards Jesus on the water, what do we all know is crashing around him? These great waves. And what does Peter do? For a brief second, he takes his eyes off of Jesus and he looks at the crashing waves. He feels the wind whipping around him, the spray of the ocean on his face. He sees the crack of lightning and the dark clouds, and Peter gets scared. And he starts to sink in the water because he takes his eyes off of Jesus. For a split second, Peter did something that made him better and drew him closer, literally drew him closer to God. And he took his eyes off of the one that could help him do that and began to sink. So what's the lesson here? You ask those questions. What's my gift? What can I do for you? And is this going to make me better? And is it going to draw me closer to you? And you have the courage to jump out of the boat and do it. Who do you need to keep yourself focused on? Who do you need to keep your eyes fixed on? None other than Jesus. None other than Christ. Discernment and using your gifts, and even in dating, because dating is a type of discernment. When you're with another person, getting to know who they are, that's what dating is. Spending time with another person exclusively to learn who they are and to learn who you are. I dated a guy once. I mentioned this in the women's session earlier. He was very outdoorsy. And I thought, like, oh, I can change. Like, he likes, you know, going out in the woods and shooting things. Like, I guess I could do that too, you know. And I very quickly discovered that's not me. That's him. And that's a beautiful thing about him that I'm not attracted to, and I know that about me now. Dating reveals things. So if you're in this dating relationship with another person, ask yourself, does being with them make me better? I dated a guy once who gossiped endlessly. Endlessly. Like, that is all we ever talked about was other people. And then when we were with people, like friends, we were talking about other groups of friends that we may have been with the day before. It was exhausting. I couldn't keep everybody's, like, storyline straight in my head. Being with him did not make me better. It made me more competitive. It made me angrier. It made me looking for chances to cut people down. Does this person make me better? Do they draw me closer to God? Those are your two questions in any situation, at any given moment. Is what I'm about to do going to lead other people to him? Is what I'm about to do going to glorify my Heavenly Father? You know, I am not the expert on discernment. Far from it. When my now husband and I were dating long distance, we did not get to see each other for the entire season of Lent 2015. I had a lot of chocolate over the 40 days. It wasn't an intentional, like, we gave each other up. I was traveling and he was traveling, and our schedules just didn't sync up to where, like, he could come down to Louisiana for a weekend or I could go up to Pennsylvania. And it was about the halfway point through the Lenten season where we got into the biggest fight that we have ever had to date, even in our married life. I called him one afternoon. I was leaving school, and Tommy worked an 8-to-5 job, and I worked a 7-to-3 job. I definitely won that one. And so I called him, like, at 3 o'clock as I'm leaving school, and he, like, you know when you can tell when somebody ignores your call, like, it rings once, and then it goes straight to voicemail? So he ignored my call. And I'm a woman, so of course I got upset. And, I mean, guys get upset about that too, but we women tend to over-exaggerate. So then I sent him the standard, like, 15 text messages, where are you, why aren't you answering me? And then when he didn't reply to the first two, like, the other 13 came. And he was clearly ignoring me at this point because I could see that he was active on Facebook. That is, like, the worst thing that Mark Zuckerberg ever invented, knowing when somebody's there but not there. So, like, I am, like, having a little mental breakdown because my boyfriend, who I have not seen at this point for almost 23 days, is not responding to my phone calls, is not answering my text messages. So when he finally does call me back and I find out he'd been in a meeting with his boss, so, like, I should not have been upset. I was, irrationally so. I just let him have it. Like, I wailed on him. Well, you could have told me you were going in a meeting. Like, all it took was, like, a 30-second text message, not even a 3-second text message, before he went in and, like, I'm not proud of it. Just unloaded. And he's, my dear, darling husband is the most patient man in the universe. He has to be. He's married to me. But he I can hear him breathing. He was like, let me call you back. And he hangs up on me. That is not the reaction to an upset woman who you ignored for an hour. Let me call you back. And he didn't call me back for another hour. So I am, like, my heart is racing. I am sweating an inordinate amount. I am furious. Like, have half a mind, I'm not proud of this, to book a flight and go up there and knock on his door and be like, what the hell, man? Like, what are you doing? You should miss me just as much. So he finally calls me back, and very simply, in a very calm, loving Tommy way, we need to talk. Dun, dun, dun. Like, oh, okay, Mom, this is it. He's pulling the plug. 7 months in, yanking the cord, like, we're finished, we're done. I should not have lost it on him. And as right as I'm about to, like, go into this big, long, like, I'm so sorry, I, you know, like, give all these excuses for why I was upset, all he simply said was, I think we need to discern where we're going to go from here. Like, as in, one of us needs to move. And my heart sunk, not because I was, you know, relieved that he wasn't breaking up with me, but because I recognized that there was now a shift. It was no longer Katie and Tommy 1,200 miles away, and we're going to figure out this long-distance thing. It was now Katie and Tommy, and one of us is going to have to walk away from their family, from their jobs, from the comfort that they have known for their entire lives. And so I just very simply said, I'm really bad at discerning. Just like threw it out there. And they said, that's okay. Jesus is going to take care of us. That's the kind of guy that he is. Like, he just says things like that and like makes me fall in love with him all over again. So for the rest of Lent, we very seriously discerned what the Lord wanted us to do. The Divine Mercy Novena had brought us together, so we prayed another Divine Mercy Novena. And on Divine Mercy Sunday, that, you know, that year, I was up there with him. It was over, you know, my spring break from school. And we discerned and prayed that Tommy needed to pursue moving to Lake Charles. And it became very obvious that that was the way to do it for a number of reasons. Oftentimes when you're discerning something, all the signs are there. And you just have to put the puzzle together. God doesn't hide things from us. We're not like a horse on a buggy with a carrot dangling in front of us. And God's like trying to trick us into following his path. He satisfies every thirst. He answers every desire. He gives us the desires of our hearts because those desires he has placed there. So he gives us all the puzzle pieces and helps us put them together. Discernment is putting that together with him, helping him guide you in putting that big picture together and seeing that bigger plan. I had just written a book about a high school. I couldn't necessarily just pick up and leave that high school. I had a house. Tommy was living with his parents. I was a little more established in Lake Charles. Tommy had had a 3 to 5 year plan of being in this position in Scranton, and then he wanted to move anyway. So this was year three. It made sense. There were all these signs that pointed, but there was one hang up. That was going to be hard to do. See, when God calls you to glorifying him in your life, he doesn't say, and it's going to be easy and awesome with butterflies and rainbows all the time. How did Jesus glorify God the most? He died. And that's not me trying to be dramatic. If Jesus Christ glorified his heavenly Father in the most perfect way possible, and he did it by suffering. It was hard. When you discern whether you're going to date so-and-so, whether you're going to go into that convent or go into the seminary or even just apply to the seminary or call the nun, because that's the first step, just telling somebody, hey, I'm interested, it's half the battle. If you're discerning how you can use this gift or that gift, how you can glorify God in this way or that way, you cannot expect it to be a rose-covered path. There's going to be some thorns. There's going to be some big rocks you're going to have to climb over. There's going to be some bumps. There's going to be some bruises. There's going to be some hurt. And guess where Jesus Christ is the whole time? Right there with you, walking with you, helping you glorify him with you. See, that's the beauty of Jesus. He didn't just like throw out these ideas and say, hey, you should do this. He came here and did it with us. It's the beauty of our faith. Our faith doesn't say like, hey, you should just have this faith in this like invisible God. We have 7 visible signs of his grace and mercy in our sacraments. The church doesn't just say, hey, use your gifts to glorify Jesus and not give us opportunities to do so. That's why we have choirs. That's why we have lay ministries. That's why we have priests and nuns. See, the church invites us into opportunities to share our gifts for his greater glory. So what I want you to do right now is turn to the person next to you. Everybody's like looking at me like I grew a second head. Do it, really. Turn to the person next to you. Smile at them. Look at them lovingly. And here's your question. I want you to share with them an answer to this question. It's very simple. Very, very simple. I'm going to look up at the people in the nosebleeds as I deliver this question. Hey, y'all. Y'all are beautiful. Your question, what gift do you think you have to bring to the altar? Okay? If you don't have an answer, that is not the end of the world. It's okay. You're not going to fail. But what gift do you think you have to bring to the altar? 30 seconds, go. 10 seconds. Free from sin?
Yeah.
All right. Question number two. This is a doozy. If you're not sharing that gift already, what's holding you back? Go. Ten seconds. All right. I hope and pray that those two questions, what gifts do you have to bring, and if you're not sharing them, what's holding you back, go with you into your small group conversations, into your dinner conversations, into conversations with the random people that you've been putting clothespins on, which, for the record, my hair is not fair game for that, okay? It's not. Yes, it's big, but we're trying to keep it contained. I hope that the gifts and the talents that you have to offer the world are not put under a bushel, but are shown light for all the world to see. And as we wrap up, we have 6 minutes left. And I'm a teacher by trade. That's what pays my health insurance and what I wake up for in the morning. And I love it. I love being a teacher. And my favorite thing that I do as a teacher, so every third week of the 9 weeks, so we're split up into 9 week, 4 quarters throughout the course of the year, I play a little game with my students called Stump Miss Prejean. I have to change it to Stump Miss McGrady, but that's, you know, neither here nor there, which is pretty great. So we play this game, Stump Miss Prejean, and what kids get to do is put questions, really about any topic, into a basket. They're anonymous completely, and I answer them for them. And 99% of the time, the questions are kind of crazy, but then occasionally there's like a real gem in the question. And those are with high school students that have to sit there. So I can only imagine what some questions would be like from people that wanted to actually come listen to me. My students can never get over the fact that people like pay me to talk about Jesus. They're like, really? And like people willingly go? It's like, yeah, shut up. Stop making me feel bad about myself. I don't actually say that to my kids. I mentally say it. So we've got now 5 minutes because I'm a blabbermouth. So questions not about anything and everything. Like I don't want somebody to get up and say, hey, when are you and Tommy going to have kids? If we NFP'd correctly, not for a while. But like, if you have any like legitimate questions about discernment, about using your gifts and talents, even about dating, which I kind of avoided with a 10-foot pole on purpose, but if you have a question, now is the time. Yeah. Okay, so the question is, I mentioned it earlier in my women's session, I have a spiritual director, and how did I go about finding him? It's kind of a funny story, as most things are in my life. He was my confirmation sponsor. I had a crisis of faith when I was in high school. I'll share that with you tonight in the keynote. And he was the academic director of my high school at the time. He was the guy that checked all the lesson plans. So students never really interacted with him or saw him. But for some reason, Deacon Vayu, he's from New Orleans, and he has a really big lisp, and he's got kind of a hunchback, so he's just kind of a strange-looking man. And I loved him because I'm a strange person. So, like, we, like, hit it off. And I would go talk to him in his office. And, like, he really helped me through my crisis of faith. And he was just an awesome presence in the school. When I moved back to Lake Charles, I had a spiritual director who was a priest. He was my former youth minister. He'd become a priest. He was working in the chancery. All I did was ask him, hey, will you be my spiritual director? And if you're looking for a spiritual director is a person that, the best way I can describe it would be this. Every single person in the world is walking around with a sack of beans on their back, okay? And oftentimes that sack of beans weighs us down and it's very heavy. And let's say there's a little hole in the bottom of the sack. You're looking forward, trudging along your journey of life with this gigantic sack of beans, and very, very slowly some beans are dropping out the back. And you can't tell because you're looking forward. A spiritual director is somebody that walks alongside you like a half step back and notices that the beans are falling out and helps you mend the holes. And then they also look ahead for you. They have like supersonic vision and they can see further ahead the challenges that might be in your path. And they help you discern ways in life to better glorify God. So the first priest that I asked, whom I love very dearly and is still a very good friend of mine, it wasn't working out. Sometimes you go into spiritual direction and like the two of your personalities kind of clash. And he was very fond of pontificating, so he would basically give me a homily for 45 minutes. So I knew that wasn't going to work. Like, they were very lovely homilies, but like I wanted to talk and like I wanted to unpack things. So I was kind of in this weird, like, I don't have anybody. And I went and had coffee with Deacon Vaille one day. And we were just chatting, and I was like, hey, would you mind, you know, maybe, like, taking me on for spiritual direction? He was like, well, isn't that what we're doing already? So it just was kind of like a natural progression. Sometimes spiritual direction is very formal, and if you're a young man or young woman discerning the religious life, I would especially encourage you to seek out a spiritual director, especially a priest or a sister who has been through what you've been through. If you're a young person in a committed relationship or you're engaged, or even if you're married, you know, Tommy and I go to spiritual direction together as a couple and also go separately now. Because it's something that we need to, as a couple, need to know where we are spiritually and where we are together. It is a great gift. But don't be afraid to ask. And oftentimes in your dioceses, like in the chancery office or at your parish, they have lists of people that have been trained to do this, that have gone through spiritual direction themselves to be able to offer sage wisdom and advice. Don't come ask me. That happened at a conference once. Somebody's like, would you be my spiritual director? It's like, how? Through Twitter? Like, you live 1,000 miles away from me. So talk to your youth minister. If that triggered something in your head, talk to your youth minister. Any more? One more? Yeah. So I did. So did I ever spiritually discern religious life? I did. When I was a freshman in college, I was convinced there was going to be a nun, mostly because boys weirded me out, but also because I felt that tug. Like, I thought that's how the Lord wanted me to serve. And I actually visited a group of sisters in New Orleans, Louisiana, and spent the weekend with them and did a discernment retreat. And so I'm gonna say this, and some people disagree with me when I say this, but I'm still gonna say it. Your vocation is not supposed to always be comfortable. It's not. I am an introvert. I love my alone time. I am not a naturally affectionate person. My love language is not physical touch. Marriage is hard for me. My husband likes to hold hands. His hands are clammy. That's tough. He also snores when he sleeps. I apparently punch him in the night. I'm not responsible for sleep, Katie. Not my job. Marriage is a challenge for me because of my personality. To be a sister, and this is what the mother superior of this particular convent, she told me, she was like, Katie, you make a great nun. You sit down and read books all day and write about Jesus? Like, you would love that. She's like, but I don't think that's how God wants to stretch you. And I think our vocations are meant to stretch us. They're meant to pull us into a deeper sense of trust. And so every day that I'm loving Tommy and he's loving me, and I just sometimes want to just go like lock myself in the office and read and write for hours and hours, it is a sacrifice to sit on the couch with him. That sounded so terrible. Please do not tweet that. Katie Prejean said it is a sacrifice to sit on the couch with her husband. I mean that it is a stretch for me to do something that is not always my first choice, if that makes sense. So I did seriously discern it. And I think every young woman needs to. Just like every young man needs to discern the priesthood and needs to discern married life and needs to discern single life. The Lord can use you for something. I can't wait to see what the Lord does with your lives. It's going to be so awesome. Like, think about it. The Steubenville Conference has been going on for 40 years across the country outside of main campus for like the past 20, which means that my generation and your generation the next 10 to 15 years are going to start sending their own kids back to Superbowl conferences, like, what kind of a world are we going to have? It's going to be bomb. Like, I can't wait to see it. So we have time for one more. Somebody like, okay, a gentleman. We haven't had a guy. Yeah. Ask a nun or a priest. How do you know if you're called to religious life? I'm trying to find the words. That would be a great question for Father Martin, and I'm not like taking a punt on it, being like, oh, you stumped me. I think a person knows their vocation. A person knows what they are called to do in life when that thing, living that life, is what's going to get you to heaven and is going to bring you the holiness and the sanctification in your life. And it will be a constant question to make sure that this is what the Lord wants for you. Just like every single day you're discerning, is this action or is that action what you want for me to do? But I think, like, the do you know, like, the voice of God, like, this is what I'm meant to do. Every priest and nun that I have ever visited with, and I have a number of very good friends, there were 8 priests and a bishop at our wedding. We had 3 nuns and 5 seminarians. So we were, like, stocked with all of the vocations. An overwhelming sense of peace oftentimes comes over people to where there's no longer this fear. There's no longer this anxiety, regardless of what other people say. One of my dearest friends, he's a seminarian. His parents hate the fact that he's becoming a priest. And it is so sad because he is, like, so in love with being in seminary and, like, eventually, but they're struggling with it because that's their only son. And they just can't get over the fact that the family name's not going to be passed over. And even though his parents are looking at him and constantly, like, making jabs about, like, are you sure you really want to do this? He still has this great sense of fortitude and peace. So I think that peace of the Lord that overwhelms your heart, and again, the sisters and the priests in the room, please, you know, continue to talk about this with young people. Don't be scared to walk up to us. They're, like, the most joyful, beautiful people on the face of the planet. Like, go talk to them. And the priests that are around here, like, first of all, they're a priest in T-shirts, which I think is the coolest thing ever. Second of all, they gave up their weekend to come hang out with 4,000 high school students. That's a lot. Y'all could trample us. Like, that's a lot of people for them to come spend time with. Go talk to them. Just sit down and say, like, hey, Father, I'm struggling with this, or I'm really excited about this. What should I do? Thank you all so much for your time. I'll be around. We can chat some more. Enjoy dinner. You're going to dinner. And go to confession.